doing okay in these strange times we're in. How bizarre so-called reality can be, especially looking at the news. It feels like we're in a sci-fi movie, in a way. The British Geological Survey says that a magnetic reversal may now be in progress. Betelgeuse might go supernova, giving us what might look like two suns, at least for a while. More strange bird deaths reported now in Beijing. Another terrorist bombing in Russia. And that strange news from Greenland, that the sun rose 2 days earlier than its usual arrival. And there's so much more we could add to the what the heck is going on list. Well, if it's true that consciousness drives the universe, and if we look at the state of most people's consciousness, then maybe it makes sense that many things around us right now have an uncertain quality to them. We're going to proceed down the path of strangeness today and talk with Gary Vey, who is an investigative researcher behind ViewZone.com. And this is an exclusive to Red Ice Radio, as it's the first time Gary does an interview like this. He joins us from New Zealand. He's written a book called The Never Ending that is available in PDF format on his website. And under the name Dan Eden, Gary takes us around the globe from Alaska's Real Harp facility, Colorado's ancient petroglyphs, to Yemen, where the Palace of the Queen of Sheba holds clues about the buried Ark of the Covenant. We follow along in Gary's story as he's been meeting with insiders and whistleblowers connected to Harp. He's been searching for an ancient language, writing that can be found on the American continent and on the Palace of the Queen of Sheba. Gary have translated these so-called fire letters, giving clues about the Box of El, or what most likely is the Ark of the Covenant, connecting ancient accounts of fire in the sky with modern harp technology. This is a fascinating conversation about Gary's discoveries and journey, so stay with us as we go through the story in the next following 2 hours. Hello there, Gary Vey, all the way from New Zealand. It's good to have you with us on Red Ice. Welcome to the program, sir.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Excellent. Gary, I've been enjoying your website, ViewZone.com, for quite a few years now. How long have you been online? How long have you been doing the website, Gary?
Well, I started it back in 1996, back when the Internet was still kind of primitive. And it's grown. The audience was small at first, a few thousand a month, and we've grown to have an audience of a million, so that's pretty cool.
That's really cool, absolutely. And you've been, I guess if we have some listeners with us who are not familiar with your style of both journalism and the way you go about things, maybe you can just give us a general outline of the kind of work and investigative journalism that you do on the website, Gary.
Okay, well, this we started the website really before blogs were popular, so we're not modeled after that. But generally, I started writing articles that about topics that I was interested in, and I found out that people were interested in those same topics, so I kept writing. We initially started the website when X-Files was popular on TV, and the kind of conspiracy theories and mysteries were a popular topic. And that grew us for the first 2 years. I didn't really pay much attention to the statistics at first, and then around 1998, I noticed that we were having more than 100,000 people visit the website, and that seemed to be pretty incredible to me. So I got serious about it and asked other people to submit articles, and we got some good material from some people. Some of them stayed with us for a few years and contributed a lot. Mm-hmm. And along the way, some really interesting topics were flagged to my attention, and literally took me around the world to investigate them. And we continue today with some interesting topics that people suggest. Each one seems to outdo the last one. But we try to keep interesting and always listen to suggestions from readers.
Absolutely. So have you personally always been interested in the fringe, if I use a kind of an overarching term there?
Well, I've always been curious about stuff, and I've always been a skeptic. So when I hear somebody coming on to a website or writing a story and say they have all the answers, a little red flags go up, and I try to do some investigation and research and see where they got their information and if it's valid. And a lot of the stories that you'll see on ViewZone are some are validating things that are what I would call internet myths. And some are actually debunking them when the information warrants it.
So absolutely. And what is that a difficult process? Do you think in some cases, because obviously there's always areas and topics where from our point of view as being observers of these kinds of things, it's difficult to verify. And I guess it's in that regard, it's better to put a question mark on something than to claim it's the ultimate truth, if you know what I mean, Gary.
Right. Well, one of my jobs that I had, legitimate jobs, was as an information specialist, and I was taught how to do research, mainly on the internet, to find source material and to validate source material. So usually I'll read a story, and if someone makes a claim, I'll go and see if that claim is supported by any legitimate documentation. And a lot of times you go around in a big circle, as you probably know, where somebody gets information from a site who got information from another site, and you keep following it to the source, and you find out that it's really somebody misunderstood something, or it's a misquote.
Right.
So a lot of that happens, but then there's a lot of surprises. And in the book that I've written, The Never Ending, there are some people that made suggestions to me that seemed like they could be outrageous, and yet when they were investigated, they ended up being quite amazing and true.
And that's definitely something I want to talk about here as well as we proceed and go deeper into some of these areas and topics, of course. The Never Ending, that's a free web or an ebook that you have available on the website. Tell us a little bit about that, Gary.
Okay, well, this came about as an experience that I had in 1998 when somebody suggested that I would do a story on the HARP installation, or what was commonly referred to as the HARP installation in Alaska. And at the time, I didn't know anything about this. And somebody went through all the trouble of calling me at the ViewZone office and actually sending me plane tickets to fly to Fairbanks, Alaska, and put me up and showed me around and gave me an amazing story that I came back and wrote up on ViewZone. It starts there, but it goes much deeper from Alaska. There's another article that was suggested to me about some ancient writing that was found in Colorado, and I checked that out and found out that writing also existed in Yemen, of all places, and Israel, and Australia. And so that was another trip around the world to see that ancient writing actually did exist and could be translated. And oddly enough, the two stories, the Alaska HARP apparatus and this ancient language, have a connection. And it was because of that connection that I wrote the book. I want to say, first of all, that the stuff in the book was a little difficult for me to write because, again, I'm kind of a shy person. And all of this stuff happened to me. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and was the receiver of a lot of very strange information from readers of ViewZone, and was able to put it together and really have an amazing story out of it.
All right, that sounds really interesting. Do you want to talk a little bit about the connection, HARP, and this the language connection? I mean, I remember a really fascinating article that was many years ago now that I read on your website, Gary, that basically went into the idea of an original language, trying to track down if there was validating the story of Babel, Babel's Tower in the Bible. Basically, that we had one language to begin with, and then something happened which kind of split it up, if you will. But what is the connection there, Gary?
Well, the HAARP installation that I was taken to was not the one in Gakona, Alaska, the one that has a website and most people, you know, have seen pictures of. The one that I was taken to was in a place called Poker Flats, which was north of Fairbanks. And I was taken to this installation by two former Navy people who worked there and actually constructed it. And wanted to tell me anonymously that this installation had been fired up and used, and that it had created harm to the atmosphere and had actually hurt some people. And they actually took me around to see the installation, and then later took me to see some of the indigenous people up there that had suffered from the testing of this apparatus on two occasions where they used billions of watts to energize it. And this was later seen echoed in some of the ancient texts when they talked about a phenomena called burning from the sky. And some of the ancient texts had prophesied a hole being created in the protective layer of the sky and burning of people. So it was kind of a coincidence.
So that's interesting, kind of a second HAARP type facility than in Poker Flats. Do you know if this basically had the same function as the one we do know about? This is the same atmospheric heater technology we're talking about, right?
Right, and I don't really want to claim to be an expert in HAARP or anything. I was shown the installation so that I could write an article about it and say that it had been used. And that it had caused harm, which I did. I wrote a story, and then got a reaction from the NSA, wanting to know who had told me about this because they had violated their national security oath. It was kind of a touchy situation.
Do you know to this day why the two military people took you there then? Did they want to expose this to the world in one way anonymously and wanted to do that through you? Or what was their reason, do you know?
Well, and they had thought it was a good venue, I guess, to expose this. And they made it clear they didn't want me to reveal their identity. Wouldn't let me take any pictures or anything, but let me speak to a number of people who were up in Fairbanks who had either worked at the facility or at one time I was taken to a place where there were indigenous people, and I met people that had suffered from this and people that had lost loved ones because of radiation up there. So this was, I mean, at the time I knew nothing about this. I was just given some technical papers written by Eastland, describing what the heater is, what they thought what the heater could do. And initially it sounded like a great thing. It would it could change weather and it could beam power from remote locations to be used where you needed power. But especially the weather changing capability of it seemed really great. And I was surprised that this was not used for some peaceful way and ended up being used as a weapon system. And that's what they were really ticked off about, is that it was used as a weapon and that it had been tested two times. The first time had caused harm, and then it was used a second time just to see what would happen. And they had all the data, and they showed me all the data. And I came back. It was hard to make the story up without revealing who they were. I had to pretty much clean it up. But I wrote it, and for a while I didn't get any reaction. But then I got visited by members of the NSA, two gentlemen that took me to an Air Force base and interviewed me and tried to have me tell them who these people were, reminding me that these people had done something bad by revealing this information and had violated an oath that they had taken, really tried to intimidate me. I realized at the time that I really didn't know if these people had given me their real names or anything, so I didn't know what kind of information I had, but I tried to resist as much as I could. Eventually, it was just agreed that I would not write anything more, and that if I heard from these people, I would contact them again.
You're in New Zealand now, obviously, but were you living in the United States at the time, or how did that work?
Sure. I was living in Massachusetts at the time.
Yeah.
Well, it's a long story. I mean, this is a difficult story to tell because there are so many twists and turns. After I wrote the story, a little bit of time passed, and then I started to get reports from people in Serbia. Telling me that they noticed a phenomena that happened when the A-10 Warthogs were used over there, that before the raids, they would see the sky turn black, and it wouldn't rain, but they'd have huge hailstones falling. And then later I got a report that there was a hole in the magnetosphere over Serbia. So I just posted that story, and right at the end of the story, I just put a link to the HAARP story. No comment or anything, just a link to it. Mm. And that was enough to get visited again by the gentleman and again warned that I should not make reference to that and that I had agreed not to write anything further about it. So that was kind of intimidating.
Hmm. So do you feel comfortable talking about this now then, or how?
Yeah, I do. Enough time has passed, these were the early days. Mm. Eventually, I was put in touch with a woman who I would call at a Washington area code and let the phone ring and then hang up, and then she would call me back. Wherever I was, whatever phone I used, this would happen. And her name was Kathy, or that was the name she used. And she was more or less my handler. She would talk to me and say, well, have you heard from them? And, okay, well, you know, she was like the soft touch. But she asked a lot of personal questions about my life and eventually discovered that I didn't have much money, that I had invested a lot of money in VueZone to get it started. And she had sort of sympathy with me and had me fantasize about what kind of a situation it would take to make me happy and that I wouldn't bother with this HAARP thing anymore. And I said, well, you know, if I had a nice job, I'm a programmer. It would be nice to have a job as a programmer, and it'd be nice to have a good salary and live in a good place where I'd be happy again. And she said, well, what place would that be? And I had gone to the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and I kind of remembered I had good times there. It was a college town, and so I just threw that out. I mean, we were just fantasizing anyway. And was about a week or two later, she called me back and offered me a position as a programmer with a company, and it was right around Amherst. And asked me if I was interested in taking it, and reminding me that all of this was a quid pro quo arrangement. And I took her up on it, and I ended up being the webmaster of the entity that controls the, oddly enough, controls the power grid for the northeast of the United States.
Okay.
At the time, they deregulated the electrical energy, and everything was done over the internet. In other words, generators were controlled and everything else, and they were just building the website. And lo and behold, I got hired as the webmaster, and I did that position for 2 years. When we approached the 2000 year mark, there was all that Y2K fear,
right,
and the fear that terrorists might control the website or somehow get control of the passwords, and they could control the generators and wreak havoc. That I was then required to myself take a national security oath and went to Fort Meade and stayed with these people for about a week to learn all the implications of what I was going to do. And I actually signed the paper, and then they pretty much had me.
Okay.
So then I couldn't talk about anything or do anything. So I think that was great. You want me to continue with the story?
How did that get to? I mean, are you off the hook of that from that now, or I mean, how does this carry on? How does it continue, Gary?
Well, because of the twists and turns that happened, the talking about the heart thing became more or less irrelevant because of the next stage in the adventure, where somebody had written to me and told me that they had found an ancient language in Colorado. And they thought that it wasn't Indians, but it was somebody else. And it was actually an alphabet. And that reminded me that the Indians didn't have an alphabet, and that who could this be, and would I come out and take pictures of it and post it on the magazine. So this kind of like was a good chance for me to forget about the harp. I had a nice job. I was living in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is the home of Smith College, which is an all-girl college. And I was a young man then, too. So that was kind of a nice place to live and a nice place to be. And I'm single. I was single at the time. So I was having a good life and making a good salary. And it was a good change for me. So I said, okay, forget about the harp thing, and we'll just do something totally different. And I took a trip out to Colorado and photographed all these petroglyphs that a gentleman had been had observed when he went out in the countryside. And he had documented them all and figured out there were about 22 different shapes of symbols, and they were written in a linear fashion, and they seemed to be a language. So I went out, and he showed me around. I took pictures of them. I came back. I wrote a story, and I posted it on the magazine, and then waited for months. And, oh, I got all kinds of crazy theories of aliens and things like this that were written, but nothing substantial until one day, a man from Brigham Young University, he called me, and his name was James Harris, and he said that he had some pictures he wanted me to see, and then sent me some pictures of the same petroglyphs that I had seen. I asked him where these were in Colorado, and he said they weren't Colorado, they were from the Negev Desert in Israel. And that he had successfully translated them using an old Hebrew dialect called Proto-Canaanite.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, can you translate any of this stuff? And I sent him some of the pictures that I had taken that I hadn't posted on the website. And after a couple of weeks, he was able to come back with translations. And they weren't dramatic things. They were like, oh, there's fresh water over here, or the person that used to live here got old, so they moved to the big round house up on the top of the hill. They were like messages like that that were in the rock. But the fascinating thing was, how could this language be in Colorado and be in Israel? So I got off on a whole different tangent. That's when Harris had cancer and was unable to be involved with this anymore. But I was reminded by my contact at the NSA, Kathy, that I was a programmer. I mean, she was interested in my life. She kept calling me every week, just to make sure everything was okay. I guess that's how important it was. They didn't want me to write another story about HARP. And they wanted to keep checking
up on you a little bit. That's what you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so she said, well, you're a programmer. Isn't there something you can do? I mean, isn't there something called an algorithm? And if you knew the algorithm, you'd be able to translate it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it was true. And I went out and got dictionaries, Chaldean dictionaries and Talmudic Hebrew dictionaries. And I made a database while I was at work. On company time. Of course, they didn't know that, but I ended up with a database that runs on a web browser on JavaScript, and it has all the symbols, and you can input the symbols just like you would on a typewriter, and it'll give you the English translation. So this worked really well, and I tried some of the pictures I had taken, and it worked well. And there was one I remember, a particular petroglyph that was 60 feet wide. And it was just packed with stuff. And the interesting thing was, on the far right of it was actually a picture, a petroglyph, looked like of a ship, with sales and everything. I thought, well, this is really odd. So I formed an expedition and got some people to come with me, and we went back there to Colorado, and we actually used the program on a laptop to translate most of what we could get out of this 60-foot-wide petroglyph. And it did actually tell a journey from the Mideast across the ocean. The people landed somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico and came up the Arkansas River. We could tell all this by what they wrote. And the interesting thing towards the end was that the problem that they were faced with was how to make a Holy of Holies, which was kind of weird. And I don't know why they would need to do that. But there was many references to Yah. Y-A-H. So it seemed like Harris had found that the old language was found in a turquoise mine that was in the Negev desert that was sealed up when it collapsed, and they still had like the bodies in it, and they didn't bother to recover any of the bodies, so it was sealed up. And the date of the carbon dating of some of the wood beams in the mine was 1700 B.C. So this was very old.
1700 B.C., yeah.
Right, and there was also this language that was scribbled on the wall, and it was in this same alphabet that we had discovered in Colorado. So we knew it was old. We knew that it was from that part of the world. So all of this began to make a little sense, and then the reference to Yah, and then there was actually even a picture of how they decided to use the material from the sail of the ship that they had. There's even a picture of it packed on the back of an animal like an ox. And because they used pictographs a lot when they wrote the petroglyphs to tell a story, they would have some text and then they have a little picture that would go along with it. And they showed how they used this material to make the Holy of Holies for the Father God. So it was kind of a religious quest, but the significant part of it was further along. They talked about the burning sky. So this is where we kind of get back into the heart thing again.
Right.
They talked about the burning sky, and they talked. It had something to do with why they came there, that this was a safe area. And that was weird. And then right at the end was a collection of petroglyphs that translated to something of the effect of from the first of Yah I am to the last of Yah I am. Okay, now that was kind of weird. All right. But anyway, got all that material and came back and I wrote that up and I posted it on ViewZone. And then I started to get some emails from people, and one of them was a man named John McGovern, who was in Australia. And he was very interested in the writing, and eventually sent me some photographs from the excavation of the Temple of Sheba in Yemen. The University of Calgary had gone to Marib in Yemen and had started digging, and they found this big palace with columns, and oddly, the whole thing was surrounded by a huge wall that was like 60 feet high and oval-shaped and 15 feet deep. And all along the wall, there was writing, and it was in this language. It was the same characters, only now, instead of finding these things crudely chiseled on rocks as petroglyphs, there was an actual font. It was in a font. It was amazing. So all the shapes that I was familiar with, here they were all refined and in a row, linear, and the pictures were amazing, so I couldn't wait to start translating these. Am I going too fast for you?
No, absolutely not. This is really, really interesting, and I'm also obviously looking at some of the articles as you're talking about this that you have available on ViewZone, and we will obviously link these up as well, because First Tongue, an Ancient Global Language, introduction, that article, people can see the petroglyphs that you're talking about for themselves, obviously. We will link this up so people can take a look at these pictures, because it is really, really interesting, and I'm glad that you also brought up this the Temple of Queen of Sheba, because that is something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but it's a very interesting place. And obviously, I can't help to think about how Well, if I put it this way, then U.S. and other forces around the world that have been part in the invasion of Iraq and what have you, has now really beginning to put their eye on Yemen as well.
That's right.
And I can't help to think that that's for a reason. But do carry on, Gary. I'm certain we'll get into that later as well.
All right. Well, this is the story has so many twists and turns, so it's hard to know how to tell this story in a linear fashion.
Right.
But what happened was I got all these photographs. They were actually press releases, and they would show a gentleman standing in front of the wall, and there was a gentleman who was writing down something. He was just posed in front of the wall, and that was kind of annoying because he was obscuring some of the writing. but with Photoshop, I was able to blow up this picture, and there's a good probably 30 feet of text. This wall going all around is actually probably, a couple of kilometers all the way around it, mm-hmm. and it's text all the way around it. One line of text that goes all around the wall that tells a story. Well, I started to use the translator and get the story, and the first thing I got from the first picture was kind of a poetic verse that talked about somebody called the sun, and it said that when the happiness of the sun was poisoned, and that was a funny way of saying it, his happiness was poisoned by the news of his father having passed on. But his anger lifted when he was told of the location of the father's great box of L. And so I was like, what? What is the box of L? What could that be? Mm-hmm. And then it continued further, and it said, when the happiness of the son was poisoned by the action of the beautiful Lord's movement, the son was made happy to swear to protect the box of L and to be associated with the Lord's spirit. So here's somebody, they're talking about a son and his father and this box. So I had absolutely no idea what this was. I finished the translation as much as I could, and I sent it off to my friend John. And after a day or so, John wrote back to me, and he said, wow, that's really amazing, and told me the story of Sheba, which, according to the Quran, we don't know that her name was Sheba. We know that the kingdom that was ruled was the Sabaean kingdom or Saba.
Yeah.
And so, basically when people are saying Sheba, we really don't know her name. In the text, she's referred to as the mother of the nation, but they never used her name specifically. So that is a mystery. But, he told me according to the Quran, that the Sheba received a message from a king in the north who was Solomon, that he was aware of her kingdom and he is inviting her to come and visit him. And so she first was reluctant and then decided to visit him and had a big caravan full of gifts. And she visited Solomon. And then there's the famous meeting where they try to see who's the smartest, and they pose riddles to each other. And she was able to answer all the riddles, and then she gave him some riddles, and he was able to answer those. So they grew respectful of each other's knowledge. And then the story goes on that she became one of his wives. And then returned back to her kingdom, where she bore a child, Menelech. Now, Menelech, I guess, is the son.
Mm-hmm.
And so when all of this big thing is written along the wall, it's actually talking about Sheba's son, Menelech, and how he learned that his father, Solomon, had passed on and that somebody had come and attacked the kingdom up there, and that they had made arrangements to have him locate the ark. Now, there's another story that says that when Menelech was a man of about 16 or 18, he decided he wanted to know who his dad was, and so he went up north to visit Solomon. And the legend says that on the way, people who saw his face said he looked like David. And they were so like shocked that he had such a resemblance. And so when he finally met with his father, they formed a pact, and Menelech was given a gold ring to symbolize an agreement they had made that if anything should ever endanger the ark, that it would be in a certain location, and Menelech would know where to look for it, and he was to go and get it.
Mm.
And so basically the story on the dam. Well, I didn't tell you it was a dam yet, but That's what it is.
You just
That's
did.
What it
yeah.
was. Yeah. Okay. The reason that he got it was because they had an agreement, and he took it back. And there are other texts that were translated subsequent. Anyway, I got all this information, and I realized that this was pretty important. And I also realized that there was no one else who supposedly could translate this, which I was kind of frustrated with. It put me in an awkward position. I had only translated material from Colorado. And now it seemed that Mr. Harris, Professor Harris, was incapacitated and unable to do the translations. So it was just me. So out of frustration, I wrote up the translations and sent them to Yemen. And I didn't know who to send them to, so naively, I sent them to President Saleh. And I had the translations, and I sent them Federal Express, you know, the highest priority, whatever.
Okay.
And and then people said, oh, you're crazy, you know, it's nothing's going to happen. Well, in about a month, it did happen, and I got an invitation to be the guest of Yemen and to come and meet with the Minister of Antiquities, and that they would show me the site.
Okay.
So they definitely were interested. So
wow.
All expenses paid trip to Yemen.
Yeah.
So this was just the incentive I needed to quit my job at the electric company. And quit my former life, my comfortable life, and do something totally crazy. And I went to Yemen and actually went to the site, had some problems at the site, but that's a different story. But I got to translate some of the stuff in the museums and plaques and bronze things they had found that had the writing on it. And the story began to get filled in. And the story basically is that after Menelik retrieved the Ark, he buried the Ark in a chamber underground and was communicating with it. And we don't know whether this was verbal communication or whatever, but somehow he was communicating with it. And the Ark told him that the same enemy that had come after his father was going to come and look for the Ark in the Saba kingdom, and that he should enter into the chamber and stay with the Ark and have it buried and covered over with sand. So he told his mom this. Now, he was the only son, and the queen was totally freaked. She didn't want to know anything about this. She, you know, she says, "You're my only son. You know, you can't do that." And but she did respect that he was getting some kind of revelation from the Ark, and so she had the workers construct a chamber, especially for him to be with the Ark inside the chamber.
Mm.
But we found other texts where she said that one of the walls she had the workers make without mortar. So that it could be easily taken down if she had to rescue him. And that she also put a little hole, aperture, in the wall so that she could spy on him. Because she didn't know how long this was supposed to happen. How long was he supposed to be in this chamber with the Ark?
Mm-hmm.
She went down and checked on him and used to, there's carvings that say that she saw light like lightning and heard a thunderous noise, and she saw him tremble from the revelations he was getting from the Ark. But then after a while there was quiet, and there was one auspicious moment when she went down and removed the hole from the aperture, and a worm came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that was not a good sign. And then she had to go through this big mental anguish of whether she should break down the wall and rescue him, or whether she should leave him inside the chamber. And there's a really beautiful plaque that's made of bronze. And it's actually looked like it went around a round column, and we only have one part of it, but it's sort of a semicircle. And the interesting thing was that all the characters, all the alphabet looks like it was mass produced like movable type, and was just laid in and sort of somehow fused with bands on the top and bottom of each letter. Interesting that they had that technology, that they could do that. Anyway, this translated, and it told how she decided that if she rescued, if she broke down the wall and he was dead, that would be it. I mean, there's no going back there.
Mm-hmm.
And she would have violated the oath to let him stay there. But if she let him stay there, then there was always the hope that the ark was real and it would keep him alive. So she decided to go with that option. And then she had the workers build a chamber over the chamber that she had built before, and this time build it good so that it would stand earthquakes. And there's mention of the salt, which I didn't understand until later, that under the Yemen soil there's a thick layer of salt. I didn't understand that at the time I did the translation,
okay.
But that was the concern also.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marib was famous because of the Marib Dam, and this was something that was epic. They had a dam built that irrigated a huge area, and there was a legend that said that there was so much vegetation and fruit, and this was the middle of a desert area.
Sure.
There was so much lush vegetation that a woman could walk through the garden with a basket on her head, and when she came out the other side, the basket would be full just from the ripe fruit that fell from the tree. And this is how lush it was.
Yeah.
But the dam really was huge. And it had to be maintained. They had cats that protected the, because a part of it was organic matter, twigs and things, and wood.
Mm.
And there was an elaborate system. But now they were going to be leaving that. They were going to be leaving because her idea was to cover the chamber up and then leave the area so that if the enemy that was approaching came there, they would just see a sand dune. That was her idea.
Mm.
So what about the dam? What's going to happen to the dam? Well, that's why she built this big wall around the chamber. So right in the middle is where the chamber is, and around this there's a 60-foot wall. It's 15 feet thick, and it's made really well. And the chamber is in the middle of it. And that's basically what it is. It's a dam. And throughout history, two times the actual Marib Dam, what was used for irrigation, did break, and the water did run over the area, but the dam that they built around the chamber actually did protect it, so it was built pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she moved her kingdom to Ethiopia. She went across the Red Sea and started her kingdom there and totally left the area, and it was covered up by sand and was actually a sand dune, actually a caravanserai, because there was some water nearby. It was a place where caravans would stop, and they would be on the sand dune, not knowing that underneath them was, you know, this big structure with the chamber and the ark inside, and presumably Menelik still inside with the ark.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a famous caravan stop. Now, when she got to Ethiopia, there was a problem that they had written the whole story around the outside of the dam, and that there were records of what had happened and whatever. So she took the language and she took the alphabet that they had used in the kingdom of Saba, and she confounded it and changed the sound values. It's a sound language anyway. Every symbol has a certain sound. That's how they did it.
In other words, she wanted to confuse the language, the interpretation of some of these the writings, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So that if somebody understood the language from her new kingdom in Ethiopia and they happened to stumble on something that talked about something from the old world, they wouldn't be able to understand it.
Yeah.
And so that was the development of the Himyaritic language, which looks similar but has different sound values. And that's why she moved her kingdom. People always said, why did she do that? She had this beautiful irrigation system there, and they had a lucrative trade, caravan trade, and why go to Ethiopia, where his life was much tougher?
Mm-hmm.
And that was that system.
So that's just a quick note on that idea. I mean, if we listen to some of the people like Graham Hancock, for instance, he places the ark in Aksum in Ethiopia, I think. And there is some interesting areas there. The Libella, I think it's called, is a kind of a church in Ethiopia. I don't know if you've seen pictures of this, but there seems to be a hint that when Queen of Sheba went there, something happened there. There seems to be some kind of Templar activity actually down there as well, because they've been trying to obviously follow up on this story. But this is interesting from that point of view, because I was wondered, because we have this mystery of either she was in Yemen or in Ethiopia, but you're saying that there was a move there, obviously, between something happened in Yemen probably, and she moved everything to Ethiopia. That's interesting.
Well, no, we know why that she moved, to
okay,
the kingdom.
Yeah,
yeah. Because she was trying to protect her son who was in the chamber. So she has like a really heavy investment in that for nobody finding that.
Yeah.
Now, I can only tell you what I translated, and I don't know, if the ark is still there. I don't know if the box of El is the ark. It just seems that it makes sense that it would be.
Yeah.
My view is that everything that happened in Ethiopia was kind of a red herring, just to get people off the path and to distract them. Now, there was an interesting guy, Wendell Phillips, the character who they based Indiana Jones on in the movie. And he actually did wear a fedora, but he didn't have a whip.
Mm-hmm.
But he started he wasn't actually looking for the ark, but he was an archaeologist, and he got interested in some of the ancient kingdoms, and he started off in Ethiopia. And he worked his way back, and he actually crossed the Red Sea, and he found traces of a migration of the kingdom back to Yemen. And he's the person who first went to Marib and first talked to some of the local tribespeople, who said, yeah, well, occasionally when the wind blows right, we see these pillars sticking up out of the sand. But then later on when the wind goes, it's covered up again. And here's a few artifacts that we found when we're digging around.
Yeah.
And he noticed that the language was different, that it used the same letters, but it didn't translate. Now, when I was there, there was the University of Calgary there, who were doing the archaeological work, but the translation was being done by the American Foundation for the Study of Man. And there was one interesting moment where when I showed up, these people had been working on the dig for about a year. And, of course, I was kind of anxious to, you know, share what I knew with them and
sure.
See what they had, and maybe they'd show me some material that I could translate. But they were still using the Himyaritic sound values for the letters. They hadn't realized that the sound value was different. And what they were getting from the wall was a collection of family names. And I realized what was happening. Every time that they got to the word son, in Arabic, when you're referring to a family lineage, it's Ibn, like Osama bin Laden, son of Laden.
Yeah.
And every time they got to this word son, they would say, oh, this is a lineage, and what follows is a name of a family. And they thought it was maybe all the patrons who made the wall had their name carved in the wall or something.
Mm-hmm.
It was a craziness that they had.
Yeah.
So I didn't get very far with them. And actually they were kind of insulted that this guy with the blue eyes from America was over there trying to tell them
what
that they were all wrong. So that didn't work out too well.
Yeah,
but what we did find that ties in with the heart thing again was a prophecy wall. Apparently there was a large wall that had all these huge stones in it with writing on it. I would estimate it's probably 40, 50 feet wide,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know how tall, but we've only found a few of the blocks that were in this wall, and unfortunately somebody took the wall apart and said, well, these are great stones, what's all this funny writing on it, and they used them for the foundations of other buildings throughout the years, and a lot of times they would chisel away to make the block fit where they needed a block, so a lot of it is ruined, but there were some pieces in the Yemen Museum. Oddly enough, the most significant one was in the museum upside down. That's how unfamiliar they were with the writing. They actually had
this
upside down. So it was easy, of course, to take a picture and Photoshop it right side up.
Yeah.
And this again talked about a prophecy that and it talked in terms of agriculture. It said that that the sun, it again talked about the sun being in the chamber, and it said that he would stay there until the Lord made a fire from the sky and would open up the hole in the sky and make a fire and burn the people. And it referred to agricultural, like burning a field. And it said, only after that will the good seed rise up, meaning the good people. And it said that the sun would also rise and come out of the chamber at that time. And then there would be an era of light and life. and the son, and it even warned about using the box of El. It said, don't use it to ask for things.
Okay.
Use it to praise the Lord. Use it to praise the Father.
Okay.
And don't be selfish. Anyway, that was pretty neat. And every now and then I still, even after all these years, I still have people who will find one of these stones and photograph it and send it to me. And unfortunately, we have about 6 stones, and we don't know if they go together or where they are on the wall.
Yeah.
But each of them kind of repeats this prophecy of something happening, and it looks like something to do with the sun. And it looks like they keep referring to a protective arm of the Lord, which could mean the atmosphere, and that there's a hole, and the arm is withdrawn, and that the fire is allowed to come to the earth and burn the people. And this is a cataclysm that must happen before the age of light and life. So it's an interesting prophecy, but it all goes back to kind of the harp installation and the hole in the sky that they created, and the radiation that came through.
I have so many questions at this point, obviously, Gary.
Well, you know, it's a hard story to tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I left out a lot of things. For example, we on our trip, we witnessed some strange phenomena. We witnessed orbs, glowing orbs in the sky at night that we couldn't explain. And I could go off on a whole other tangent with that. I was with a woman who came along. I was going to make a movie. This was supposed to be my cover story for being in Yemen, because the Yemeni minister of antiquities was very concerned that if the Ark was really there, that it would create a political situation, since Yemen was a very weak and poor country, and that they were aware that the Ark is needed for the Third Temple, if you follow what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
And that if somebody really believed that the Ark was there, they might just come and take it by force.
Right.
Right. And they had another idea that perhaps, like Egypt with the pyramids, that Yemen might someday become a tourist attraction or a religious pilgrimage site where people would come to see maybe the Ark is under there. You know, maybe if they left it there and they had all this history revealed, that and it would probably build up the infrastructure in Yemen and create a new industry, because they have nothing going for them. They have no oil. They have nothing. The people are poor. It's one of the poorest places I've ever seen. Really everything dry, and you wonder how people could even live there at all. There's hardly any vegetation.
Yeah.
So this would be an opportunity for them. So they were very concerned about that, and they didn't want this revealed.
So many different things I want to talk about, but let's just focus a little bit on this, the Temple of Queen of Sheba here, before we begin to round things up for the first hour. But obviously, I want to continue with more, and I'm going to try to kind of stay out of the way a little bit here and just let you kind of continue the story, and then we can kind of get to some of these questions I have afterward. But the temple or the palace of Queen of Sheba. Some of the pictures you have on the site is, I think, from the year 2000 or 2001. Now, do you know if anything has happened in terms of excavation here? What has happened in the area since then? We're talking about 10 years ago here now.
Okay, when I left, they were just getting ready to do ground penetrating radar inside the oval structure.
Mm.
And when I left, and then I went to Australia for a while, and then came back to the States, and that was the first time I got reports that they actually did find something. They actually did find that there was a chamber there, and if it was there, it was filled with sand, because it was pretty solid, and that's to be expected, that the sand would find its way into whatever and it would be full of sand. But there was definitely a stone chamber there, right in the middle of it. What happened then was 9/11.
Oops. Yeah.
You know, I came back on the 5th of September, and had made arrangements to go back to Yemen again.
Yeah.
And then 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then some odd things. After we got over the surprise of that, a job was arranged for me to go back to Yemen as the director of the Yemen American Language Institute. Somebody arranged this job just to kind of get me in the country so I could be there legitimately with a visa. And it was all arranged. And when I went to get my plane ticket, I discovered that I had been flagged as a person of interest. And so I was unable to get my ticket. And I tried to resolve this. And the response was, well, did you know that the area where you were residing in Yemen, in Narib, was an Al-Qaeda camp?
No.
I mean, I had not even heard of Al Qaeda when I was there. But I, you know, people were everybody. Yemen is perhaps the heavily, if not the heavenliest armed country in the world, where even children have their own AK-47 with Smurf stickers and yarn all over the barrel, and they're able to shoot a gun pretty well.
Okay.
So, and during the day, we would see the tribes people. Of course, we were all heavily protected with soldiers when we were there. But we would see tribes people in the distance, you know, running around and doing maneuvers. But it just seemed like, well, what else do you do if you have a bunch of guns? You know, you practice with them.
Yeah.
Whether they were really Al-Qaeda or not, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I just think that's the way everybody lives there. Anyway, that got me very concerned because at the time, if you were a person of interest, you seemed to be going to Guantanamo Bay, or at least that was the fear, that was the paranoid.
Sure.
And so I found that the Republic of Vietnam didn't have an extradition agreement. And quickly booked my ticket there and went there to live.
Hmm. There you go. and that's just, again, we're just kind of brushing on some of the overarching themes here, because there's so much, obviously, more in detail we can go into. But obviously, the story is in the book as well, obviously, that you have on the website, where you tell the story. And also, there's so many more things I want to ask you about, Gary. I think that let's round things up here for the first hour, and then carry on in the second one, and I'll let you continue the story, and then at some point there we can talk a little bit more about some of the details, and I'll try to ask some of the questions as well. But viewzone.com, that's the main website where people can go, and there's links to the book right there.
So on the top left there's a link.
Yeah. And people can make little donations there to get a copy of the book, whatever they feel is how much they want to give you. Is that correct, Gary, or how does that work?
That's right. I'm not really selling the book, but I need to have some help to keep the website up and running.
Of course, absolutely. So people can make a little donation, whatever you feel is appropriate, and then you get access to the e-book and some of the things that we've been talking about. And again, it's an incredibly fascinating story. And I can't believe that we haven't highlighted this until now, actually. I remember one of your readers wrote a little article that he forwarded to us a while back as well, called The Parked Ark. He called it God's iPhone, which we linked up, which is hints and highlights of the story that we've been talking about here so far. And at the end of the article as well, we have some of the language codes that you talked about, this program, and also then a link to ViewZone where people can get the book as well. So that's the first thing that, when I kind of got my eyes open to this, when I said, wow, this is interesting, we need to cover this. But let's just wrap things up and see, is there anything else you want to mention in regards to the website or any kind of other material that you have out there that you want to highlight for people before we carry on with hour two, Gary?
No, I just would like to offer the opportunity for anybody that has a good story or a good theory or whatever to send it into ViewZone, because we always welcome contributions of intellectual ideas and theories and whatever, and reports from readers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like part of the salad that makes the website interesting.
All right, that is excellent. ViewZone.com. See the links from redaspirations.com. So some of the things that we've been talking about. We're going to link up images and things there as well, so you can take a look at some of the things that we've been talking about. But again, Yemen, why Yemen, and why the reason to all the so-called terrorist activity down there, and why is now parts of the Western world again beginning to look at this area. It's pretty interesting. We saw a similar pattern with Iraq, of course, the invasion of that. We had the looting of the Baghdad Museum and a lot of artifacts taken out of the country. This might be an extension in one way or another to that our overarching agenda. But again, Gary, we'll continue talking more about this in our next hour, so stay with us. Very, very interesting.
Everybody's weird.
historical events, solar cycles, catastrophe, more on Yemen, the Ark of the Covenant, and the placing of surface-to-air missile launchers inside the Palace of the Queen of Sheba are some of the things that we'll be discussing up next. Don't miss hour two as we proceed with Gary Vay from ViewZone.com, talking about his book The Never Ending and his interesting story. RedIceCreations.com is our website. Go there for all the details on how to tune in to the second hour. I recommend that you do not miss this.